Blackstone Audio presents The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Bible by Robert J. Hutchinson. For Robert, James, Kelly, Mary, and Jane. Chapter 1. Why do the heathens rage? Guess what? Contrary to what anti-religious secularists assert, far more lives have been snuffed out throughout history by faith-hating fanatics than by religious believers. The total number of people murdered by their own anti-Judeo-Christian governments in the 20th century equals about 170 million.
"We're told that 4/5 of American homes have a Bible, so go get it," bellows Penn Jillette of the controversial comedy magic act Penn and Teller on their Showtime TV series Penn and Teller, Expletive. "Really, no kidding. Go get your expletive Bible. If you don't read along with us tonight, you're going to think we're making this expletive up."
And so begins the controversial duo's debunking of the holy scriptures of Christianity and Judaism, a 28-minute foul-mouthed harangue exhibiting all the erudition of a biker bar and just about as much sensitivity. Penn, a towering lumberjack of a man with a ponytail and Norris Skipper goatee, does all the talking in the show, while Teller illustrates his points with little magic tricks.
"Tonight we're going to take you through the expletive Bible and show you it's full of inaccuracies, inconsistencies, and outright impossibilities, that it's more fiction than fact," he announces solemnly, and then, thumping his black leather Bible, he adds, "You know, being on TV in a suit and yelling with this expletive book in my hand, I look like just one of those evangelical expletive."
On and on it goes. Anyone who says that Christianity in general, and the Bible in particular, are not mocked in popular culture has not been watching TV in a while. Penn and Teller trot out a handful of alleged biblical experts, such as Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic magazine, to make their case against the Bible. "The more we learn about archaeology and history of biblical times," says Shermer excitedly, "the more we realize that most of the stuff in the Bible is fiction." Want proof? In the first chapter of Genesis, Shermer points out, Adam and Eve are created at the same time. In the second chapter, Adam is created first. See? Right off the bat, you know the whole book is a complete fraud. Inconsistencies like that just rattle your faith to the very bone.
"Sometimes the Bible is the word of God," explains Penn. "Sometimes it's the word of one man. Sometimes it's the word of two men. Sometimes the Bible is literal, and sometimes it's simply symbolic."
Clearly, this makes it unreliable and a waste of time. All of this might be merely amusing, yet another example of how high you can climb in Hollywood with a high school education, were it not for the fact that such village atheist assaults on the Bible are now commonplace in public schools, universities, the media, and even some elite seminaries. It wouldn't be so bad if these attacks on the Bible represented something genuinely new, something witty and entertaining on the level of, say, a Nietzsche or a Swinburne. But instead, they are merely repetitions of allegations made for about 1,800 years. They are as original as dirt, and about as interesting. The problem is, many of these new champions of enlightened reason, standing on high from the pinnacles of academia, don't appear to be aware that their ideas are literally millennia old. Scripture says, "Why do the heathen rage, and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord, and against his anointed, saying, Let us break their bands asunder, and cast away their cords from us." Psalm 2, verses 1 through 3. The Bible's enemies. The Bible was not exactly a raging bestseller when it was first published in the centuries after Jesus' death. The Romans didn't particularly like the Jews to begin with, considering them barbaric and quite primitive. In the Jewish Wars of 66 to 70 AD, the Romans put down the Jewish fight for freedom with definitive ferocity. Up to 1 million Jews were slaughtered, and the holy city of Jerusalem and its world-famous temple was razed to the ground. When Christianity came on the scene, it was viewed as worse, a bizarre, superstitious cult whose founder, a wild-eyed Jewish fanatic stirring up trouble, was sensibly put to death. His erstwhile followers were said to meet secretly where they ate human flesh and drank human blood. There were rumors of rampant immorality, even incestuous orgies, as the members of the cult referred to one another as brother and sister. Plainly, as new religions go, this Eastern superstition had little to recommend it when compared with, say, the elevated mystery rites of Isis or Mithra or the Stoics. And then there was their holy book. If there was anything designed to chase an educated Roman away from Christianity, it was the Christian Bible. The Christian and Jewish scriptures had to be seen to be believed, they said. A ragtag collection of folk tales, strange laws, badly written letters, biographies of wonder-working magicians, all written with no regard to literary style, verbal felicity, or the rules of rhetoric. To educated Romans raised on the polished elegance of Virgil and Cicero, Aeneas and Cato, the Christian writings were positively juvenile, filled with vulgar misspellings, absurd grammatical errors, and ridiculous plots. As the second-century Latin Christian apologist Tertullian put it, "Men are so far from accepting our scriptures, no one approaches them unless he is already a Christian." St. Augustine, the greatest theologian of the first millennium of Christianity, was so put off by the Bible he ignored it, and Christianity, for a dozen years. "It is clear to me that the writings of the Christians are a lie, and that your fables are not well enough constructed to conceal this monstrous fiction," said the second-century anti-Christian polemicist Celsus. "I have heard that some of your interpreters are on to the inconsistencies, and, pen in hand, alter the original writings 3, 4, and several more times over, in order to be able to deny the contradictions in the face of criticism." As an example of the absurd stories found in the Christian and Jewish scriptures, Celsus cites the account of Noah's Ark. "So too their fantastic story, which they take from the Jews, concerning the flood and the building of an enormous ark, and the business about the message being brought back to the survivors of the flood by a dove. Or was it an old crow? This is nothing more than a debased and nonsensical version of the myth of Deucalion, a fact I am sure they would not want to come to light." Nor was Celsus alone in his contempt for Christianity in the Bible. Around the year 280 AD, the Roman philosopher Porphyry wrote a 15-volume work entitled Against the Christians. It was a runaway bestseller for its time, sort of a third-century version of Penn and Teller, only with more education. Porphyry wrote a witty, sarcastic refutation of the Bible almost line by line. Modern-day critics insist that science, archaeology, and critical scholarship have all proven that Moses did not write one word of the Torah. They then sit back with a look of triumph on their faces, as though such a declaration will shock anyone. The trouble is, Porphyry said the same thing, only he said it 1,700 years ago. "If you believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote concerning me," Porphyry begins, quoting Jesus in the Gospel of John. "He said it, but all the same nothing which Moses wrote has been preserved, for all his writings are said to have been burnt along with the temple. All that bears the name of Moses was written 1,180 years afterwards by Ezra and those of his time. And even if one were to concede that the writing is that of Moses, it cannot be shown that Christ was anywhere called God or God the Word or Creator. And pray, who has spoken of Christ as crucified?" Of course, repeating past criticism doesn't make it false, but one might think that real journalists, assuming they exist, might be curious as to whether these criticisms evoked any responses over the millennia. There are literally thousands of books written by Christian apologists attempting to present rational answers to Bible difficulties, alleged historical or scientific contradictions, historical inaccuracies, textual variants, apparent misquotations or erroneous citations of biblical texts by later authors, and so on. Some of these explanations are convincing, others less so, often depending upon how you understand the doctrine of biblical inspiration and how the Bible came to be written. Oftentimes, the inconsistencies and errors that critics allege are found in the Bible are little more than misunderstandings of what we mean when we say that the Bible is an inspired text. Believers do not mean, and never have meant, the Bible was dictated by God in the way that Muhammad says the Quran was dictated. Even Christians who affirm that the Bible is inerrant also agree that it was written by limited, fallible human beings within a real historical context, speaking a human language with all its limitations and accommodations, making use of certain literary forms and social conventions, and possessing a certain worldview which they inherited from their time and place. In other words, proper interpretation and understanding of these ancient texts require patient study and analysis, something difficult to sum up during 30 seconds of Good Morning America. Too often, critics of the Bible mistake descriptions of actual human conduct for God's will. Whenever we read the obscene stories, the voluptuous debaucheries, the cruel and tortuous executions, the unrelenting vindictiveness with which more than half the Bible is filled, it would be more consistent that we call it the word of a demon than the word of God, wrote Thomas Paine in his notorious The Age of Reason. It is a history of wickedness that has served to corrupt and brutalize mankind. The notion that you can read an encyclopedia of ancient wisdom like the Bible, written over the course of 1,000 years, in three difficult ancient languages, by many different human authors spread across the breadth of the Middle East, the same way you read a newspaper article, only reveals an astonishing comic book, for lack of a better word, understanding of the ancient world. For Christians, therefore, these and similar attacks on the biblical texts often just seem silly, not threatening. It would be as though they heard a TV news anchor on one of the major networks announce,
"This just in. Scholars at the University of Tübingen in Germany have discovered that there is actually more than one Christian gospel written about the life of Jesus. While Christians continually refer to the gospel, it turns out that there are actually many of them, and they do not always agree on all the details of Jesus' life. The inconsistencies in the various accounts of Jesus' life raise new, often troubling questions about the reliability and authority of these foundational Christian texts."
The news that there is more than one Christian gospel, and they do not always agree on all the details of Jesus' life, may be shocking and new to members of the elite media, or even to Penn and Teller, but does not, as astonishing as it may seem, really shake the faith of ordinary believers, most of all because Christians have known these facts for two millennia. Who said it? The Bible has been the Magna Carta of the poor and oppressed. The human race is not in a position to dispense with it. Thomas Huxley. Atheist Wisdom versus the Good Book. "Thou goest to women, do not forget thy whip." Friedrich Nietzsche. "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it." Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. The elites against the people. For approximately 1.8 billion people on the planet, roughly 1 billion Roman Catholics, 280 million Orthodox, 473 million Anglicans and Protestants, and 14 million Jews, the Bible is revered, in one way or another, as the Word of God. It's a source of divine inspiration, moral guidance, and the foundation of Western civilization. There are differences among denominations, of course, but a general consensus exists among faithful Christians and Jews worldwide that the biblical texts communicate vital, often shocking and unusual truths central for our self-understanding and the key to our eternal destinies. But for an influential group of academic, government, and media elites, the Bible, far from being the cornerstone of Western civilization, is actually the source of most of the evil in the world today, a veritable cornucopia of superstition, obscurantism, and bad taste. Long before modern inquiry and painstaking translation and excavation had helped enlighten us, it was well within the compass of a thinking person to see that the revelation at Sinai and the rest of the Pentateuch was an ill-carpentered fiction, bolted into place well after the non-events that it fails to describe convincingly or even plausibly, asserts the irascible but always entertaining British journalist Christopher Hitchens in his 2007 book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Intelligent schoolchildren have been upsetting their teachers with innocent but unanswerable questions ever since Bible study was instituted. Village idiots, atheists. the term recently coined for these dogmatic, inflexible, increasingly totalitarian ideologues, is secular fundamentalist, those who believe, despite all evidence to the contrary, that the triumph of civilization has been largely accomplished through the systematic debunking and elimination of religious belief, by force if necessary. Of course, there have always been village atheists and skeptics in the West, some intelligent, others much less so, fulminating against biblical prohibitions that inhibit their lifestyles. The Marquis de Sade, for example, the 18th-century libertine from whom the word sadism was coined, insisted that religions are cradles of despotism, against which enlightened persons must rebel, primarily through lots and lots of extramarital sex.
Sex is as important as eating or drinking, and we ought to allow the one appetite to be satisfied with as little restraint or false modesty as the other, he proclaimed.
In the past, the anti-religious rants were more or less confined to isolated individuals, fulminating in tracts against society and Christianity. The 1960s and 1970s changed that as the secular fundamentalists took control of the media and many academic and government institutions. Thus, in the West, and particularly in the United States, we have the increasingly combustible situation in which most people hold fairly traditional views about the Bible and religion, while a minority of privileged elites is not only indifferent, but actually hostile toward them. If you think that judgment is too harsh, consider the case of Robert Reich. According to Reich, former U.S. Labor Secretary during the Clinton administration, the greatest danger we face in the 21st century is not terrorism, not epidemic disease, not poverty or famine or war, but religious belief itself. Writing in the American Prospect, Reich stated the secular fundamentalist viewpoint with admirable frankness. The great conflict of the 21st century may not be between the West and terrorism. Terrorism is a tactic, not a belief. The underlying battle will be between modern civilization and anti-modernists, between those who believe in the primacy of the individual and those who believe that human beings owe blind allegiance and identity to a higher authority, between those who give priority to life in this world and those who believe that human life is no more than preparation for an existence beyond life, between those who believe truth is revealed solely through scripture and religious dogma, and those who rely primarily on science, reason, and logic. Terrorism will disrupt and destroy lives, but terrorism itself is not the only danger we face. If the great conflict of the 21st century is, as Reich says, between secularists and religious believers, that would put the secularists at war with virtually the entire planet. The world's population is estimated at 6.5 billion. The number of people who claim some religious affiliation stands at about 5.8 billion. Reich and his fellow secularists see as their enemy, real or potential, the overwhelming majority of mankind. And Reich is not unique in his extremism. American universities and newspapers are literally bursting at the seams with a kaleidoscopic assortment of former 60s revolutionaries or neo-Marxists who espouse similar beliefs. According to Timothy Shortell, a professor of sociology at the City University of New York's Brooklyn College, religion without fanaticism is a logical impossibility. In a brief essay published online in 2005, Dr. Shortell elaborated on the essential link between religious belief and murder. Anyone whose mind is trapped inside such a mental prison, as religion, will be susceptible to extreme forms of hatred and violence. Faith is, by its very nature, obsessive-compulsive. All religions foment their own kind of holy war. Those whose devotion is moderate are only cowardly fanatics. It is no wonder, then, that those who are religious are incapable of moral action, just as children are. The immaturity represents a significant social problem, however, because religious adherents fail to recognize their limitations. So, in the name of their faith, these moral retards are running around pointing fingers and doing real harm to others. They discriminate, exclude, and belittle. They make a virtue of close-mindedness and virulent ignorance. They are an ugly, violent lot. The British champion of neo-Darwinian evolution, Richard Dawkins, likes to use the same sort of language.
opposition to evolutionary dogma, he says, comes from an exceedingly retarded, primitive version of religion, which unfortunately is at present undergoing an epidemic in the United States. The United States, he adds, is slipping towards a theocratic dark age. Charming, no? In the early 1990s, media elites believed, as the famous quote from the Washington Post had it, that religious people were largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. Now, alas, they've become dangerous. The handful of moderate Christians and Jews are simply cowardly fanatics. There it is in a nutshell, the worldview shared in newsrooms and faculty lounges across America and Europe. Although, truth be told, newspaper reporters have slightly better manners. For secular fundamentalists, religion in general, and the Bible in particular, are not just wrong-headed, but actually dangerous. That's because religion and the Bible stand in the way of everything they value most in life. Primarily unlimited sex, of course, but also the power to reshape society into a kind of secular utopia free from traditional ethical restraint. The sudden eruption of Islamic terrorism worldwide has given secular fundamentalists the excuse they've long needed to basically draw a circle around all religious belief, from the Taliban to the World Council of Churches to the Dalai Lama, and insist that, well, it's all the same thing. In principle, they imply, Mother Teresa was no different from Osama bin Laden. Only her methods differed. Thus, former New Republic editor Andrew Sullivan, a disgruntled Catholic upset that the Vatican won't declare homosexuality just another lifestyle choice, now writes routinely of Christianist organizations and figures. Drawing a parallel with Islamist figures who advocate mass suicide bombings, these menacing Christianist figures, Sullivan says, are now scheming to impose a kind of Christian theocracy on the enlightened secular societies of the West. Those who object to partial birth abortion, for example, or to the creation of animal-human embryos in laboratory experiments, are no different from Islamic terrorist groups. As the anti-religion crusader Sam Harris put it, those opposed to therapeutic stem cell research on religious grounds constitute the biological and ethical equivalent of a flat-earth society. Harris, the author of the 2005 bestseller and National Book Award-winning The End of Faith, and most recently, Letter to a Christian Nation, is merely one of a number of widely celebrated writers to warn the world about the growing menace of religious convictions. According to his biography, Harris is a graduate in philosophy from Stanford University, who is currently pursuing a doctorate in neuroscience at UCLA. The stated purpose of his book is not to describe an actual social reality, the end of faith, but rather to issue a call to arms to secular fundamentalists everywhere to drive religious persons of all persuasions out of the public sphere altogether. Harris openly and proudly insists that what the world needs now is intolerance, not tolerance. He reminds the educated reader of the old menacing claim by the 18th century philosophe Denis Diderot that men will never be free until the last king is strangled in the entrails of the last priest. Or, in Harris's own words, to speak plainly and truthfully about the state of our world, to say, for instance, that the Bible and the Quran both contain mountains of life-destroying gibberish, is antithetical to tolerance as moderates currently conceive it. But we can no longer afford the luxury of such political correctness. We must finally recognize the price we are paying to maintain the iconography of our ignorance. Harris's solution is to eliminate biblical religion, because the degree to which religious ideas still determine government policies, especially those of the United States, presents a grave danger to everyone. Atheist Wisdom versus the Good Book. A single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. Joseph Stalin. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your father. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore. Ye are of more value than many sparrows. Matthew, chapter 10, verses 29 to 31. The Bible in American History, Part 1.
The Bible is worth all other books which have ever been printed. Patrick Henry. It is impossible to rightly govern the world without God and Bible. George Washington. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. So great is my veneration of the Bible that the earlier my children begin to read, the more confident will be my hope that they will prove useful citizens in their country and respectful members of society. John Adams. Religion, the greatest danger to world peace? Think again. Harris's basic arguments are hardly original, but they have an unfortunate pedigree. For more than 300 years, from the French philosophes to Marx, Lenin, and the death of God theologies of the 1960s, we have been assured that, freed from the superstitions and imbecilities of organized religion, rational secularists could make the world into a utopia. The results have invariably been horrific, from the terror of the French Revolution to the terrors of Nazism and communism. Contrary to what anti-religious zealots such as Harris assert, throughout history, far more lives have been snuffed out by faith-hating fanatics than by religious believers. Historical demographers estimate that, in the 350 years between 1478 and 1834, the Spanish Inquisition was responsible for the execution of between 2,000, Encyclopedia Britannica, and 32,000 people. Paul Johnson, A History of the Jews, 1987. That works out to about 97 people a year, a ghastly number, to be sure, but a far cry from the millions routinely cited by secular fundamentalists. As for the witch hunts, another example Harris and others give of irrational religious fanaticism, the British historian Norman Davies estimates 50,000 people, primarily women, were executed as witches over a 400-year period, an average of about 125 a year. Yet as horrible as these examples of religious intolerance may be, they pale in comparison with the single-minded, bloodthirsty, satanic fury unleashed upon the innocent by secular fundamentalists, those militantly atheistic regimes that sought to expunge religion from society altogether, and which, like Harris, claimed that religious belief and bourgeois morality represented intolerable obstacles to social progress. According to research conducted by the political scientist Rudolf Rummel at the University of Hawaii, the officially atheist states of the communist bloc committed more acts of genocide than any societies in history. The total number of people murdered by their own anti-Christian governments in the 20th century, communist, socialist, fascist, equals about 170 million. USSR, 61 million people murdered 1917 through 1987. Communist China, 35.2 million people murdered 1949 to present. Mao's army, 3.4 million people murdered 1923 to 1949. Nazi Germany, 20 million people murdered 1932 to 1945. Communist Poland, 1.6 million people murdered 1945 to 1948. Communist Cambodia, 2 million people murdered 1975 to 1979. Communist Vietnam, 1.6 million people murdered 1945 to 1975. Communist Yugoslavia, 1 million people murdered 1944 to 1987. Anti-Christian Mexican Revolution, 1.4 million people murdered 1900 to 1920. Turkey, 1.8 million people murdered 1900 to 1918. Pakistan, 1.5 million people murdered 1958 to 1987. Japan, 5.9 million people murdered 1936 to 1945. And these numbers don't even include the people killed in the wars initiated by these officially anti-Christian states, such as the estimated 25 million soldiers killed in World War II. These are the people lined up against brick walls and shot, often for the crime of merely believing in God, by the rational, more scientific social planners of communist Russia and China, or anti-Christian Mexico and Germany. Rummel's conclusion is as shocking as it is inescapable. War wasn't the most deadly evil to afflict humanity in the 20th century. Government was, and not just any government, but atheist government. As a result, ordinary people, whether religious or not, might be forgiven their general skepticism when today's secular fundamentalists talk about the intolerance and violence of biblical religion or the people who believe in it. In terms of raw numbers, which is the only kind of evidence that rationalists such as Harris claim to accept, the evidence is incontrovertible. Freed of any moral restraint, believing that the ends justify the means, scoffing at the notion that they will ever answer to a power higher than themselves, the murderous dictators of atheistic regimes feel little hesitation in committing mass murder if they believe it will advance their more rational, more scientific social aims. Christopher Hitchens, in his book God is Not Great, lamely tries to deflect atheism's contribution to global genocide by insisting that all tyrannies are really theocratic, and in any event, Christianity, he says, didn't do enough to stop fascism and Stalinism. As for Richard Dawkins, he is only slightly more candid. In The God Delusion, he concedes that Hitler was ferociously anti-Christian and that Stalin, Mao, and the other communist tyrants were dogmatic atheists. He agrees that they were among the greatest mass murderers in history. But, he says, the difference between religious people who kill and atheists who kill is that there is not the smallest evidence that atheism per se influences people to do bad things. Dawkins adds, individual atheists may do evil things, but they don't do evil things in the name of atheism. But didn't the atheist dictators of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries kill priests, nuns, monks, and believers? Did they not kill in the name of science, rational state planning, and revolutionary morality? A book atheists want to burn. The Black Book of Communism by Stephen Courtois. Cambridge, Harvard University Press, 1999. This Black Book of Communism tallies up all of the horrors caused by the atheistic communist states of the 20th century. If God is dead, indeed, it was their arrogant belief in the absolute power of the state, in direct opposition to the teaching of the Bible, that led to the horrors of their regimes. It was precisely atheism's teachings that there are no bourgeois moral limits, no moral limits whatsoever, that allowed atheistic states to commit mass murder in the name of a higher cause. As Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor put it, if God is dead, all things are permitted. Most Americans, and all believing Jews and Christians, believe that there are moral limits, that all things are not permitted. Some are sinful, some are evil, and we should put our trust not in an all-powerful government, but in an all-powerful God who is himself concerned with our morality and has, in fact, revealed standards of right and wrong. We can only gasp in wonder at the wholesale historical ignorance displayed by contemporary secular fundamentalists, their utter lack of knowledge about events as recent as the fall of the Berlin Wall, when they start prattling on about how much more rational atheists are and how much more moral their social policies would be, freed from the superstitious morality of biblical religion. A century of first-hand, bloody experience with rational atheism has proven that it is atheism, not the Bible or religious belief, that is the greatest danger to world peace. Chapter 2. The Stones Cry Out. Guess what? Compared with other ancient historical works, the Bible has a tremendous amount of archaeological and historical support. Skeptics' complaints of no archaeological proof of Pontius Pilate were refuted in 1962 in the form of an inscription mentioning Pilate, Prefect of Judea. It was the most important archaeological find for the study of the Hebrew Bible since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In 1979, a team of Israeli archaeologists discovered 9 caves on the hillside just west of Jerusalem in the Valley of Hinnom. The caves were ancient burial sites that date back to the 10th century BC. Inside one of the caves, archaeologists discovered 2 tiny silver scrolls or amulets, each about the size of a cigarette butt, upon which were written lines in Old Hebrew script. This ancient writing, similar to that found on the Samaritan Torah scrolls,
is believed by some Jews to be the same script that Exodus 32:16 says God used when writing the tablets of the Ten Commandments. The tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing, incised upon the tablets. Because of their delicate condition, 4 years elapsed before archaeologists were able to unroll the scrolls. When they did, they couldn't believe their eyes. In tiny, almost microscopic letters, they saw the mysterious tetragrammaton YHWH, the sacred, ineffable name of God in the Hebrew Bible, one of the few times the full name had been found in Israel or anywhere in the world. Working with scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena in the early 1990s, archaeologists and paleographers used infrared imaging technologies and computer image processing programs to draw out previously invisible writing on the scrolls. The results took their breath away. Both scrolls, dated to the 7th century BC, had inscribed upon them the priestly blessing from Numbers 6:24 through 26. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord cause his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. The significance of this find was immediately apparent. In that hillside cave in Jerusalem, the archaeologists had happened upon the oldest extant piece of the Hebrew Bible in existence, one dating 4 centuries earlier than the Dead Sea Scrolls. But equally important, the discovery called into question recent skeptical theories that postulate that the Torah was written very late, during or even after the Babylonian exile of 560 BC, by scribes who learned their monotheism from Zoroastrian priests in Babylon. Instead, the writing on the tiny silver amulets suggested that the Hebrew text of the Torah was in existence much earlier than skeptical modern scholars have assumed, and was so revered that portions of it were inscribed in silver and worn around the neck. The discovery of the Ketef Hinnom amulets, as they are known, is an example of how recent archaeological discoveries are often strengthening more traditional views of the Bible's origins, undermining some scholarly certainties. The Israeli archaeologist Yohanan Aharoni, hardly a conservative, insists that recent archaeological discoveries, such as the Ketef Hinnom amulets, have decisively changed the entire approach of Bible critics. No authors or editors could have put together or invented these stories hundreds of years after they happened. This isn't the first time that archaeological discoveries have undermined the unquestioned certitudes of modern skeptics. Time and again, archaeology has verified the existence of places, people, and events we once knew solely from biblical records. These discoveries by no means prove that the Bible is divinely inspired or inerrant, but they do bolster the credibility of the biblical texts as containing real historical records. A few examples. The Merneptah Stela. In the 19th century, as in our own, some scholars questioned the reliability of the biblical narratives. Then, as now, some even suggested that the Israelites never really existed at all as a separate people. That is, until a 7-foot slab of black granite was discovered in a temple in Thebes, Egypt, in 1896. Written in hieroglyphics, the stela boasts of the Egyptian pharaoh Merneptah's conquest of Libya and peoples in Palestine, including the Israelites. One line reads, "Israel is laid waste, its seed is not." Archaeologists have precisely dated the stela to year 5, 3rd month of Shemu, summer, day 3, or 1209 to 1208 BC. This is definitive proof that not only did a people known as Israel exist in the 1200s BC, but they were known in Egypt. Israel is grouped together with other defeated city-states in Canaan, such as Gezer, Yanoam, and Ashkelon. Scripture says, Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Matthew chapter 4, verse 4. The House of David inscription. In our own time, so-called biblical minimalists, such as Thomas L. Thompson at the University of Copenhagen, have claimed that many central characters of the biblical narratives are completely fictional, that such figures as King David or Solomon never existed. But then, on July 21, 1993, Archaeologists working at Tel Dan in northern Israel, near the foot of Mount Hermon, uncovered a basalt stone, written in Old Aramaic, that explicitly mentions the House of David. Pottery fragments near where the stela was found date it to the end of the 9th or the beginning of the 8th century B.C., and certainly not later than the Assyrian destruction of Tiglath-Pileser III in 732 B.C. The stela refers to events recorded in the Old Testament book of 2 Kings and refers to how the writer killed Ahaziahu, son of Jeroham, king of the house of David. The Moabite Stone, or Misha Stela. Compared with other ancient historical works, such as Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War or Caesar's Gallic Wars, the Bible has a tremendous amount of archaeological and historical support. One of the earliest pieces of evidence that the biblical chronicles concerned real persons and events was the so-called Moabite Stone discovered in 1868 by Anglican medical missionary F.A. Klein. Written in Moabite, a language related to Hebrew, around the year 930 B.C., the stela is the personal testimony of a Moabite king that mentions numerous places in the Bible. "I am Misha, son of Chemoshmelech, the king of Moab, the Dibonite," the stela begins. "My father was king over Moab for 30 years, and I became king after my father." The chronicle goes on to mention Israel and its God by name. "And the god Chemosh said to me, 'Go take Nebo against Israel,' and I went by night and fought against it. And I took from there the altar hearths of Yahweh, and I dragged them before Chemosh. And the king of Israel built Jabaz, who dwelt in it, while he fought with me, and Chemosh drove him out from before me." This text was written in 930 B.C., yet biblical minimalists claim that Israel didn't even exist as a separate people at that time, and certainly were not ruled by a king. The Moabite text mirrors closely texts in the Bible, such as 2 Kings 3, verse 4 and 5. "Now Misha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel." Ironically, after the House of David inscription was discovered at Tel Dan in 1993, scholars returned to the Moabite stone, housed in the Louvre in Paris, and began studying it more closely. French scholar André Lemaire discovered that the same phrase, House of David, appeared in line 31 of the Moabite stone. It reads, "And the house of David dwelt in Haranan. Chemosh said to me, 'Go down, fight against Haranan.' I went down, and Chemosh restored it in my days." The new evidence even led Time magazine to conclude in 1995 that "the skeptics' claim that King David never existed is now hard to defend." The Bible in American History, Part 2. Education is useless without the Bible. Daniel Webster. Pharaoh Shishak, or Shashank's, victory lists. The Book of Chronicles relates that the Egyptian pharaoh Shishak, or Shashank, came with 1,200 chariots and 70,000 horsemen and plundered Israel's capital, as well as such towns and fortresses as Rehob, Megiddo, and Hazor. Archaeologists have long known that Shashank's exploits, carved on a monument in the Temple of Amun at Karnak, have been confirmed by extra-biblical sources. But a discovery in 2003 at Tel Rehov in Israel, using highly sophisticated techniques of radiocarbon dating, provided additional proof that the biblical account is precisely correct. In the process, it also undermined the theories of biblical minimalists or skeptics, such as Israel Finkelstein and Thomas Thompson, who claimed David and Solomon never existed. The radiocarbon dating placed Shashank's looting at Rehov in the 10th century, 925 B.C., rather than the 9th. Additionally, it established that the cities Shashank mentions conquering, including Beth-Horon, John 10:10, Gibeon, John 9:3, Megiddo, John 12:21, and Gaza, John 10:41, all existed when the Bible says they did. These discoveries have now put another nail in the coffin of skeptic Israel Finkelstein's theories, concluded Professor Lawrence E. Steger, director of Harvard University's Semitic Museum, in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle. There is no question that Rehov and the other cities that Shoshonk conquered were indeed there at the time of Solomon. We don't need to rely anymore only on the Bible or on Shoshonk's inscriptions at Karnak to establish that Solomon and his kingdom really existed, because we now have the superb evidence of the radiocarbon dates. Samaritan Ostraca. The Bible goes into great detail about the tribes of Israel, even going so far as dividing up the 12 tribes into specific clans or families. Some modern scholars don't take this seriously and doubt that there really were 12 tribes of Israel at all. That flies in the face of evidence that was discovered in 1910 under the direction of the Harvard archaeologist G. A. Reisner in Samaria. 63 potsherds bearing inscriptions in Old Hebrew script, written in ink, called ostraca. Among the oldest samples of ancient Hebrew writing, the ostraca are commercial records of shipments of wine and oil, but they have one characteristic of historic significance. 30 of them name the clan or district name of 7 of the 10 sons of Manasseh, mentioned in Joshua chapter 17, verses 2 and 3, including Abiezer, Azriel, Helek, Shechem, and Shemida. 2 daughters of Zelophehad are also identified, chapter 17, verse 3, Hoglah and Noah. These potsherds are dated to around 784 to 783 B.C. The Seal of Baruch. In the fourth year of King Jehoiakim's reign, circa 605 B.C., God spoke to the prophet Jeremiah and told him to write his prophecies on a scroll. Perhaps if the house of Judah hears all the disasters I intend to bring upon them, they will turn back from their wicked ways, and I will pardon their iniquity and their sin, God told Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 36, verse 3. So Jeremiah called Baruch, son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote down in the scroll, at Jeremiah's dictation, all the words which the Lord had spoken to him. Jeremiah chapter 36, verse 4. In 1975, a bulla, or clay seal, bearing the name of the scribe, was discovered in the antiquities market in Israel. Written in Old Hebrew, pre-exilic script, the bulla was dated to around 600 B.C. and authenticated by some Israeli archaeologists. The writing on the bulla reads, left to right, Veberechaya, blessed of God, Ben Neriah, son of Neriah, Haseper, the scribe. Many scholars and archaeologists believe the seal belonged to Baruch ben Neriah, the scribe who faithfully recorded the visions announced by the prophet Jeremiah and described in Jeremiah chapter 36, verse 4. Even more interesting, in 1996 a second bulla was discovered, presumably stamped with the same seal, and upon which was found a thumbprint embedded in the rock-hard clay, perhaps that of Baruch himself. While not all archaeologists are convinced these bulli are genuine, given the sometimes shady character of the Israeli antiquities trade, they are nevertheless further evidence that the people in the Bible were not mythic characters, but real historical figures. The Pontius Pilate inscription. When contemporary skeptics complain that there is no archaeological proof that a certain biblical figure existed, such as Moses, what they often don't admit is that there is little or no archaeological evidence for many figures of ancient history that no one seriously doubts existed. This argument from silence has been refuted so many times you would think that modern skeptics would stop using it. For example, until 1962, there was no archaeological proof that Pontius Pilate ever existed, and skeptics made much of the fact. But in that year, an Italian archaeologist working at Caesarea Maritima, on the coast of Israel, south of Haifa, the center of government for the Roman administration in the time of Christ, found the long-sought proof. It came in the form of an inscription that mentioned Tiberium Pontius Pilatus Prefectus Iudei, Tiberius, the Roman emperor of the period, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. The Ebla Tablets. Some modern skeptics now concede that there may have been a minor chieftain named David, but nevertheless insist that the patriarchal narratives are entirely fictional, and no figure such as Abraham existed. What's more, they used to say, the places that Abraham visits in Genesis don't actually exist. We have no archaeological evidence for any of them. Then, in 1964, Italian archaeologists from the University of Rome began excavating a palace found at Tel Mardik in northern Syria. Inside the palace, they found a virtual library of 15,000 well-preserved cuneiform tablets dating from around 2300 BC. Not only do these amazing tablets, written in Sumerian and Akkadian, reveal laws, customs, and events surprisingly in harmony with the account in Genesis, they also mention explicitly the five undiscovered cities on the plain mentioned in Genesis 14:8 that modern skeptics insist never existed: Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Zoar. The Siloam Tunnel, or Hezekiah's Tunnel. According to 1 Kings 2 and Chronicles 2, an elaborate tunnel was constructed during the reign of King Hezekiah, between 727 BC and 698 BC, to protect Jerusalem's water supply against an imminent Assyrian siege. Most biblical scholars have long believed the 1,750-foot-long tunnel, rediscovered in 1838, did indeed date back to the time of Hezekiah. A minority insisted the passage was built centuries later. Some even claimed that an inscription at the outside of the tunnel proved it was built just before the birth of Christ. But once again, archaeology has proven the textual skeptics to be wrong. In 2003, Israeli and British scientists tested organic material within the plaster lining of the tunnel and dated it back to around 700 BC, just as the Bible says. The testing represented the first time that a structure mentioned in the Bible was dated through radiocarbon methods, according to researchers Amos Frumkin, Arya Shimron, and Jeff Rosenbaum in their published results in Nature, September 2003. The Nuzi Tablets. A common tactic that critics use when attacking the historicity of the biblical narratives is to point out cultural anomalies, customs that allegedly didn't exist in the period in question. For example, skeptics point to a number of customs in the Pentateuch that, they claim, do not correspond to what we know about the Middle East in the second millennium. But excavations in 1925 at Nuzi, in northern Iraq, discovered 4,000 tablets written in Akkadian cuneiform script that dated back to 2300 BC. The Nuzi tablets describe customs that parallel those described in Genesis. For example, a barren wife giving a slave, such as Hagar, to her husband to produce an heir, or a father choosing a bride, like Rebekah, for his son. Once again, archaeological discoveries have disproven what was once known. Archaeological supports for biblical records. These examples show how unique the Bible really is in the context of other religions' holy books. While they do not prove that everything in the Bible is factually accurate, some chronological and historical correlation problems still remain, they certainly do demonstrate that the Bible's records of events do have substantial outside support from archaeology and other historical records. Certainly the Bible differs in a remarkable way from many other holy texts, such as the Hindu Bhagavad Gita or the Buddhist Tripitaka, where the connection to proven historical facts is tenuous at best. There should be no more reason to doubt the truth of Old Testament historical documents than there is to doubt classical Greek historians Herodotus or Thucydides, whose descriptions of ancient events often lack substantial archaeological support. The Exodus. For centuries, scholars have debated the historical reliability of the biblical account of the Exodus. But until the late 1970s, biblical scholars, historians, and archaeologists took the biblical account of the Exodus, if not at face value, then at least as a broad outline of historical events. However, beginning in the late 1970s, a small but increasingly influential group of revisionist scholars came up with a novel way to account for all of the conflicting archaeological and textual evidence. None of it happened at all. It was all just made up. Put another way, the central event of Jewish history, recounted faithfully each year in the Passover Seder, was a complete fraud, made up out of whole cloth. The first scholars to seriously propose this thesis appear to have been a group of Scandinavian and American scholars working at the University of Copenhagen in the late 1970s and 1980s, such as Thomas Thompson, Niels Peter Lemke, and Peter Davies. While different scholars disagree about the details, This school of thought, which is known as biblical minimalism, basically holds that the Bible is a work of fiction with little, if any, verifiable basis in historical fact. The characters in the Hebrew Bible, from Abraham and Moses and David up to and including Jesus Christ, are merely nationalistic mythic constructs, no more historical than Odysseus in the Odyssey and Aeneas in the Aeneid. When the anti-clerical denizens of the media finally got wind of this story in the late 1990s, they had a field day. Despite the fact that the arguments against the historicity of the Exodus are hardly overwhelming, or could at least be considered debatable, the media predictably proclaimed that the matter was settled. The Bible had been proven false by archaeology, or not just false, but an actual fraud, a deliberate lie, perpetrated and perpetuated by religious zealots, not unlike the Taliban, determined to oppress women, perpetuate homophobia, enforce the death penalty, and so on. Time magazine featured a cover story in 1995 entitled, "Is the Bible Fact or Fiction?" that swallowed the arguments of the minimalists without question or even comment. If they really spent 40 years wandering in the desert after fleeing Egypt, the Israelites should have left at least a few traces, the Time article asserted. But though scientists have evidence of human occupation in the Sinai dating to the Stone Age, nothing suggests that the Israelites were ever there. The March 2002 issue of Harper's went even further. It carried an article written by Daniel Lazar entitled, "False Testament: Archaeology Refutes the Bible's Claim to History." Not long ago, archaeologists could agree that the Old Testament, for all its embellishments and contradictions, contained a kernel of truth, wrote Lazar. Obviously, Moses had not parted the Red Sea or turned his staff into a snake, but it seemed clear that the Israelites had started out as a nomadic band somewhere in the vicinity of ancient Mesopotamia, that they had migrated first to Palestine and then to Egypt, and that, following some sort of conflict with the authorities, they had fled into the desert under the leadership of a mysterious figure who was either a lapsed Jew or, as Freud maintained, a high-born priest of the royal sun god Aton, whose cult had been overthrown in a palace coup. Recent archaeological discoveries, Lazar continued, changed all that. In the last quarter century or so, archaeologists have seen one settled assumption after another concerning who the ancient Israelites were and where they come from proved false. Eventually, even some clergy started parroting this line. Rabbi David Wolpe of Los Angeles told 2,000 worshippers at the conservative Sinai Temple that the way the Bible describes the Exodus is not the way it happened, if it happened at all. This is an astonishing remark for a rabbi to make. After all, the events of the Exodus have been central to the religious understanding of Jews and Christians for millennia. Every Passover, Jews meet together for the ritual Seder meal when the story is retold of the Israelites' liberation from bondage in Egypt. What is the basis for this new skepticism? After all, for most of the 20th century, archaeologists and historians generally believed the Exodus, in some fashion, actually occurred, even if they were unclear how all the details fit together. In 2001, an Israeli archaeologist named Israel Finkelstein and a journalist named Neil Asher Silberman wrote a book that summarized and gave new life to the minimalist cause. It was entitled, "The Bible Unearthed: Archaeology's New Vision of Ancient Israel and the Origins of Its Sacred Texts." One argument the authors put forth in the book is that the Exodus didn't happen at all because it's difficult to fit all the known historical dates together. Finkelstein and Silberman discuss the Hyksos, the mysterious West Semitic people who overwhelmed Egyptian society in the 16th century BC and who were forcibly expelled from the kingdom. The Egyptian historian Manetho, circa 250 BC, describes how the pharaoh defeated the Hyksos, killing many of them and pursuing the remainder to the frontiers of Syria. Finkelstein and Silberman concede that the basic situation described in the Exodus saga, the phenomenon of immigrants coming to Egypt from Canaan and settling in the eastern border regions of the Delta, is abundantly verified in the archaeological finds and historical texts. But, they say, it's impossible to reconcile all these dates with the biblical account. So what is Finkelstein and Silberman's conclusion? It must be all made up. But as we have seen, as difficult as it is to fit all the pieces of the historical puzzle together, saying the whole story is fiction is hardly the only, or even the most logical way, to account for all the evidence. The Hyksos, for example, may have merely been the forerunners of the Israelites, one of the first of many waves of impoverished Semitic peoples to seek refuge in Egypt over the course of centuries. We know from the Armana letters, a series of cuneiform letters dictated by the pharaohs Amenhotep III, circa 1391 BC, and Tutankhamun, circa 1330 BC, and discovered in the late 19th century, that there existed groups of foreigners known as the Apiru, or Habiru, who were considered to be brigands, or disenfranchised peoples on the outskirts of society. While the Apiru cannot be simply equated with the Hebrews, the Egyptians may well have considered any Israelite tribe riffraff, who were a threat to Egyptian society. Middle Eastern historian Robert Stieglitz of Rutgers University argues that carvings on a chapel of Egyptian queen Ma'akari Hatshepsut refer to the expulsion of the Hyksos in 1550, but also to a second, later expulsion of a group with foreigners amongst them, a reference that closely mirrors Numbers 11:4, which states that the Israelites fleeing Egypt included a mixed multitude, a safsuf, and not merely the Israelite tribe. As for the city the Bible calls Ramesses, said to have been built by the enslaved Israelites, archaeologists concede that it was indeed built and occupied at the time the Bible gives for the Exodus, but may have been called by a different name at that time. There are many ways to account for the conflicting evidence other than to simply assert that none of it happened. A second point against the Exodus that Finkelstein and Silberman make is that we have no written records of Israelites in Egypt from Egyptian sources. The authors point out that, after the forced expulsion of the Hyksos around 1570 BC, the Egyptians established a network of forts along their eastern frontier. Some of these forts have been discovered and excavated. Archaeologists have even found a papyrus that shows how closely the Egyptian border guards, like today's customs and immigration officials, monitored movements of tribes and peoples. "We have completed the entry of the tribes of the Edomite Shasu through the fortress of Merneptah Content with Truth, which is in Chikwa, to the pools of Peritum," reads one entry on the papyrus. So, what does this evidence tell Finkelstein and Silberman? If a great mass of fleeing Israelites had passed through the border fortifications of the pharaonic regime, a record should exist. Of course, this assumes that detailed, comprehensive records written on papyrus scrolls more than 3,200 years ago, still exist and have survived millennia of wars, revolutions, invasions, fires, floods, and other disasters. Worse, say the authors, there is no record of Israel and Egypt whatsoever, no tomb inscriptions, no monument, no writing on the temple walls. They concede that the famous Merneptah stela, found in Egypt in 1898 and erected by Pharaoh Merneptah, son of Ramses the Great, does mention Israel by name. Reliably dated to around 1208 BC, the stela clearly identifies a culture of people named Israel, whom Merneptah battles in Canaan. "Israel is laid waste, its seed is not." But the absence of the name Israel in Egyptian inscriptions really proves nothing. The aristocratic, clean-shaven Egyptians no doubt thought of the descendants of Jacob as just another mass of hairy Semitic marauders, like the hated Hyksos. What's more, the Egyptians, like all ancient peoples, weren't in the habit of making monuments to their failures, like mass escapes of slaves. However, this doesn't stop Finkelstein and Silberman from taking their argument a step further to assert that a mass migration of people was actually impossible during the reign of Ramses II. In addition to pointing out the system of forts along the Egyptian border, mainly along the coastal ways of Horus, they point out that Egyptian power at the time of Ramses II was at its peak, and the Egyptians maintained military control over Canaan. But there are a number of problems with this argument. First, it assumes that the Exodus occurred in the era of Ramses II, when there are textual arguments against that dating. And second, it ignores the fact that the Bible itself specifically insists the fleeing Israelites did not take the coastal road lined with forts, the way of the Philistines' land, though this was the nearest, Exodus 13:17, but that God led them south toward the open desert by way of the Red Sea. And, of course, the Bible does describe the Egyptian army pursuing the fleeing Israelites. No fewer than 600 first-class chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt, with warriors on them all. Exodus 14:7. The text even names the place where Pharaoh's whole army caught up with the Israelites when they were encamped at Pihahiroth, in front of Baal Zephon, two place names that have not been identified. The text then describes one of the greatest miracles of the Bible. Whether you understand the crossing of the Red Sea as it is described in Exodus 14:22, with the waters divided like a wall to their right and their left, or prefer to think of it in more naturalistic terms, as an army in heavy battle armor getting bogged down in swampy marshes of the Sea of Reeds and drowning, there is nothing inherently unrealistic in the basic scenario outlined in the Exodus account. Pharaoh's army gave chase to the fleeing, escaped slaves, and fell victim to some type of disaster involving water, with the heavy infantry and charioteers drowning in the Red Sea. But, say Finkelstein and Silberman, then why is there no archaeological evidence of a large group of people wandering in the desert for 40 years? The obvious answer to anyone familiar with the Sinai Desert is that though it is a vast, forbidden wasteland of about 24,000 square miles, it has nonetheless been traversed by countless armies over the millennia, from the Roman legions to the armies of Arabia, and has been the scene of ferocious battles fought by the Arabs and Israelis in the 1956, 1967, and 1973 wars. Finkelstein and Silberman say that despite repeated archaeological surveys in all regions of the peninsula, not a single piece of evidence has turned up of the Israelites' generation-long wandering in the Sinai. Not even a single sherd, no structure, not a single house, no trace of an ancient encampment. This is known as an argument from silence, and you would think that archaeologists would be humble enough to no longer make them. That's because some of the most embarrassing gaffes in the history of archaeology have been the result of such arrogant arguments from silence. Finkelstein and Silberman make much of the fact that archaeologists have identified many of the specific places mentioned in the account of the Exodus and haven't found any evidence of ancient encampments there. Specifically, they point to Kadesh Barnea, where the Bible says the Israelites encamped for 38 out of the 40 years of wandering in the desert. The general location of this place is clear from the description of the southern border of the land of Israel in Numbers 34, say the authors. It has been identified by archaeologists with the large and well-watered oasis of Ain el-Kudeirat in eastern Sinai, on the border between modern Israel and Egypt. Well, there you have it. Imagine, after 3,000 years, not a trace of an Israelite encampment, even one that lasted 38 years, remains. Of course, the truth is that the identification of Ain el-Kudeirat with the biblical Kadesh Barnea is not universally accepted, but that is a standard tactic of the biblical minimalists who seek to undermine the believability of the biblical narratives, to treat as settled scientific facts what are, in truth, merely the opinions of one group of scholars or archaeologists. The author's final refutation of the Exodus as a historic event is the claim that it is merely a fictional story told to unite the Israelites during the reign of King Hosea in the 7th century B.C. There is only one major problem with this argument. Some of the biblical prophets, such as Amos and Hosea, whom many scholars confidently date living a full century before King Hosea, have numerous allusions to the Exodus and the wandering in the desert. "When Israel was a child, I loved him," said Hosea. "Out of Egypt I called my son." Hosea 11:1. Amos begins one of his prophecies with the words, "Hear this word, O men of Israel, that the Lord pronounces over you, over the whole family that I brought up from the land of Egypt." Amos 3:1. If the Exodus was merely a work of fiction, written between 640 and 609 B.C., then how could the prophets have made references to it a century earlier? Finkelstein and Silberman explain this conundrum by agreeing that there was indeed a shared memory of a great event in history that concerned liberation from Egypt and took place in the distant past, but that it had nothing to do, really, with the Israelites per se. Rather, there was a general collective memory of the expulsion of the Hyksos from Egypt, and the authors of the biblical texts merely appropriated this collective memory and made it their own. What Finkelstein and Silberman propose is that when it came time to invent a new national epic saga, The authors of the Torah chose to fashion a history for themselves, first as abject slaves in Egypt, and then to imagine themselves invading the land they already occupied, and indeed had always occupied, destroying all their neighbors' cities and engaging in centuries of bloody warfare with their own people. In New Testament studies, when something is inherently embarrassing, such as the apostles being dim-witted, historians tend to think of it more likely being true as not, because people don't tend to make up stories that make them look bad. When we think of other national sagas, such as the Iliad or the Aeneid, we read of heroic exploits. The Greeks, far from being abject slaves freed only by the power of God, venture forth to repair their wounded honor and destroy the Trojans in an epic battle. In the Aeneid, the Trojan Aeneas journeys to Italy and helps to found a new people destined to rule the world and establish truth, justice, and the Roman way. Finkelstein and Silberman want us to believe that royal scribes created a national epic for the Israelites that depicted them as impoverished slaves. Who said it? I claim to be a historian. My approach to the classics is historical. And I tell you that the evidence for the life, death, and the resurrection of Christ is better authenticated than most of the facts of ancient history. E.M. Blakelock, Chair of Classics, Auckland University. A book atheists want to burn. The Stones Cry Out, What Archaeology Reveals About the Truth of the Bible, by Randall Price, Eugene, Oregon, Harvest House, 1997. Irrefutable? The five basic arguments against the Exodus in The Bible Unearthed may seem irrefutable to the authors, but not to many other distinguished archaeologists and scholars. Egyptologist K.A. Kitchen argued in his 2003 book, On the Reliability of the Old Testament, that the factual details of the Exodus account, salt-tolerant reeds in the Red Sea, the habits of quails, kiwirs, mudflats south of the Dead Sea, and so on, reflect detailed, precise knowledge of real local conditions, not something a creative novelist could know, sitting in Babylon or Jerusalem. As for the arguments from silence and the lack of Egyptian records, Kitchen points out that a handful of wine vintage dockets from broken jars is the sum total of our administrative texts so far recovered from Pi Ramesi. In other words, it's not as though we are holding 3,000 years' worth of comprehensive passport and immigration records and can say, see, there is no Jacob from Canaan listed as passing through the frontier border check. Concerning the lack of a single sherd in the Sinai, Kitchen also points out that terrified fleeing refugees might be more inclined to take water skins into the desert, not earthenware amphorae that would leave sherds in the first place. Chapter 3. All Scripture is God-breathed. Guess what? Most modern skeptics' attacks on the Bible are based on a profound misunderstanding of what most Christians and Jews mean by biblical inspiration. Most alleged biblical inconsistencies are simply the result of modern people imposing their own standards and values on ancient peoples with radically different lifestyles and outlooks. The Bible's account of its own origins reads like something out of a Hollywood movie. According to Exodus, sometime in the latter half of the second millennium, between 1500 and 1200 BC, the Egyptian pharaoh's adopted son, named Moses, probably short for the Egyptian name Thutmoses, led a massive uprising of Semitic slaves who fled from Egypt into the desert wastes of the Sinai Peninsula. There, at a mountain called Horeb, the people had a terrifying encounter with a mysterious divine power, surrounded by smoke and fire, that shook the mountain, Exodus 19:18, like an earthquake. This power, which the Bible elsewhere calls El Elyon, or the Most High God, not only communicated with Moses directly and gave him detailed instructions for the people, but told him to write everything down. Then the Lord instructed Moses, write this down as a permanent record. Exodus 17:14. Then Moses carefully wrote down all the Lord's instructions. Exodus 24:4. And the Lord said to Moses, write down all these instructions, for they represent the terms of my covenant with you and with Israel. Exodus 34:27. What's more, according to Exodus 32:16, this mysterious divine power gave to Moses the laws we know as the Ten Commandments, inscribed on stone tablets. The first set of tablets was destroyed when the Israelite people worshipped the golden calf, but Moses received a second set, and these were placed in a special gold-covered chest, the Ark of the Covenant, that the Israelite people carried throughout their sojourn in the Sinai. Later, the Ark was placed in the temple built by Solomon, and was kept there until it mysteriously disappeared sometime around the Babylonian invasion of the 6th century B.C. But before the Ark disappeared, 2 Kings 22 and 2 Chronicles 34 relate how, during the reign of King Josiah, circa 640 to 609 B.C., the people of Israel had fallen into apostasy and were practicing the abominations of the pagans, such as child sacrifice through burning. King Josiah set about reforming Israel and ordered a massive repair effort of the temple be undertaken. During repairs on the temple, the ancient Book of the Torah of YHWH by the hand of Moses, 2 Chronicles 34:14, was rediscovered somewhere in the temple precincts. Most scholars believe that this book was likely Deuteronomy. Later, the king gathered all the leaders of the people near the temple and read aloud to them the entire text of the Book of the Covenant that had been found in the house of the Lord, 2 Chronicles 34:30. He stopped the practice of child sacrifice, removed every abominable thing from all the territory belonging to the Israelites, and made a covenant before the Lord to follow the Lord and to keep his commandments, decrees, and statutes with his whole heart and soul, thus observing the terms of the covenant written in this book, 2 Chronicles 34:33. Despite the Israelite repentance, however, it was too late. Over the course of several campaigns, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, circa 605 to 562 B.C., conquered Judah, sacked Jerusalem, despoiled the temple of its treasures, and dragged a portion of the population into forced exile. After the Babylonian exile, the temple would be rebuilt, albeit on a more modest scale, and then greatly expanded under King Herod the Great in the decades before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth. But the Ark and the famed tablets of the law were lost to history. Many people believe that the temple priests, aware of the impending Babylonian invasion, would almost certainly have hidden away such a precious treasure of Israel, as the Qumran community hid the Dead Sea Scrolls from the advancing Roman legions in 68 AD. The book 2 Maccabees, written in Greek around 124 BC, refers to ancient records that describe how the prophet Jeremiah took the ark and hid it in a cave on Mount Nebo, 2 Maccabees 2, 4-10, a remark that most scholars dismiss as legend. This book is continued on Disc 2.